Beijing and Hong Kong government seems to be very, very adamant not to back down to any of the protester demand.
Hong Kong tensions gain altitude while flights don't. It's Tuesday, August 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, warm water is killing cool coral. A landmark international treaty turns 70. Robots fill a human shortage. Disappearing insects and the meeting of a lifetime. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators filled Hong Kong's international airport Monday, forcing the cancellation of all flights. No violence was reported at one of the world's busiest airports, where protesters were still gathered inside the main terminal late into the night. On the streets of Hong Kong earlier Monday, enraged protesters blocked roads and defied police orders to disperse after riot officers fired tear gas and non-lethal ammunition at fleeing crowds. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Ho Fung Hung, professor in political economy in the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. He is an expert in protest, in nation-state formation, and East Asian development, to name just a few.
It is becoming more and more unpredictable right now because Beijing and Hong Kong government seems to be very, very adamant not to back down to any of the protester demand and hoping that draconian crackdown can make the movement die down. But at the same time, protesters and more Hong Kong people now, even including some ordinary citizens, they are increasingly angry about, first is the extradition law, and now more and more angry about the police tactics and violence against peaceful protesters. So now it is a deadlock right now.
Is there another side to the story? We seem to be covering the protester side. Is there another side to the story?
Other side of the story is that there's a reason police press conference, and because a lot of journalists already find out and put it into the video clip that actually there's some policemen pretending to be protesters as undercover, and they are doing some rock throwing and even Molotov cocktail throwing and some wild things, and then to incite other protesters to do, and then when the other protesters try to do something and they arrest them on the spot. And in the most recent police press conference, that the police responsible person actually acknowledged that there is some policemen doing undercover among the protesters. So some of the protester violence seems to be coming from the undercover police over there. So it is some new development that makes people also more angry about the police tactics.
China has used the word terrorist when describing the protesters in Hong Kong. In your mind, is that a signal of Chinese intervention in the handling of the protest? Is that what's going to happen?
I think it is a worrying sign. First of all, that the police, the protesters have been doing things that is far away from terrorism, because terrorism means indiscriminate hurting of people and killing of people, including civilians. But the protesters right now is haven't done anything like that, and rather that some of the gangsters that widely believed to be mobilized by the establishment has been doing indiscriminate beating of passerby and people and create a kind of a terror. So it is worrying that the Chinese government now is saying that the protester has some hint of terrorism, because it might indicate the Chinese government would support more the extreme and draconian crackdown, like what they do in Xinjiang, for example, that they have been saying that the protester and the dissidents in Xinjiang are terrorists. So their label of terrorism seems to be a kind of a precursor of more draconian crackdown.
What are these protests doing to Hong Kong as far as people who live there, as far as the business interest of Hong Kong?
Definitely that some disruption. For example, people who are scheduled to fly in Hong Kong airport yesterday is going to be affected, that they might need to find another flight the other day. And some retailers, of course, their business is affected. But right now, as some public opinion poll already show, and general sentiment about ordinary people in Hong Kong, they not yet put the blame a lot on the protester, but they put the blame on the government for mishandling the crisis and the police tactics that escalate the conflict. Back in June, that the government can easily defuse the protest by withdrawing the bill and setting up an independent inquiry commission. But it seems that the government they have been doing so far is to putting gasoline into the fire rather than trying to to calm down the situation. So it seems that the Hong Kong people's lives are affected, but right now it seems that more people are blaming the government for that.
What about Xi Jinping? Is his position difficult now?
I think it's very difficult because if things go on like this, that Hong Kong reputation and also the international recognition of Hong Kong as a separate independent custom territory and the offshore financial center, which is very useful for China, very useful for Chinese elite, it might be in jeopardy. So I can imagine that many Chinese elites are putting pressure on Xi Jinping to resolve the crisis without major bloodshed and peacefully, and Hong Kong get back to business. But at the same time, Xi Jinping definitely doesn't want to look weak on this. So he is so far adopting the policy of not backing down an inch. So he is really caught into this dilemma. That either way, that there will be cost and there will be risk, and so he definitely is in a very difficult position.
Ho Fung Hung, professor in political economy in the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. Tens of thousands flee homes in flood-hit Myanmar as landslide toll hits 59. Protesters fill Hong Kong's international airport. Rights groups demand immediate release of iLabor 3 as China deepens crackdown on labor activists. As China looms, Vietnam aims to develop a more modern skilled navy. Belgian company on, quote, dirty list cuts ties with Myanmar. You'll find a great list of stories and so much more when you visit our Facebook page at VOA Asia, as well as our website, that's voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Marine heat waves are a much bigger threat to coral reefs than previously thought. That's according to research from Australia. It says bursts of heat are killing reefs almost instantly, leaving the coral with no chance of recovery. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Severe marine heat waves have been shown to cause mass bleaching in coral, which destroys its colorful symbiotic algae that are its main source of nutrition and can cause the coral to starve. Since 2016, warmer waters on the Great Barrier Reef have killed off about half of the coral on Australia's greatest natural treasure. But new research shows that as well as triggering bleaching, heat waves can directly kill the coral itself. Scientists suggest that severe heat wave-induced mortality events are a distinct biological phenomenon which inflicts damage that's different from coral bleaching. The study asserts that if water temperatures are so warm, the coral animal doesn't bleach, it dies, and its underlying skeleton is all that's left. The research team has used a CT, or computerized tomography scan, to help determine their results. Imogen Zathoven is the strategic director of the Australian Marine Conservation Society.
We've got a crisis on our hands with the warming of the oceans, even at 1 degree above pre-industrial levels of carbon emissions, that corals are dying immediately from severe heat stress. We have to act urgently. We have to act and drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
The study has been published in the journal Current Biology. It involved researchers from four Australian universities and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. The Great Barrier Reef in northeastern Australia is about the size of Japan. It's home to an array of marine creatures, including 600 types of coral, 500 varieties of worms, and more than 100 species of jellyfish. Scientists warn it's threatened not only by warmer ocean temperatures, but also overfishing, industrialization, and the runoff of pollution and pesticides from farms. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, residents in Indian-controlled Kashmir offered prayers at neighborhood mosques on the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha, but curfew-like restrictions muted festivities in the region. That has been in virtual lockdown since New Delhi revoked the area's autonomy last week. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. And events marking the 70th anniversary of the 1949 Geneva Conventions are underway. The International Committee of the Red Cross says these four landmark treaties delineating the law of war are as relevant today as they were when they came into force August 12, 1949. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The 1949 Geneva Conventions grew out of the horrors of World War II. It took only 4 months for the four treaties, which are universally ratified, to come into force. The treaties contain the core elements of the international humanitarian law, the law of war, which aims to reduce suffering in armed conflict. The law requires all parties to a conflict to abide by provisions that include a prohibition against torture, appropriate treatment of civilians, caring for the wounded on the battlefield, and the dignified treatment of the remains of the dead. ICRC Director of International Law and Policy, Helen Durham, recognizes the law of war is not always followed, but she notes when they work, they have an impact. She says ICRC delegates in the field see these laws in action every day.
We see, for example, the capacity for us to get fresh water to 6 million Syrians. This is the law of war in action. We see every time a wounded combatant passes a checkpoint to get access to medical assistance, it's the laws of war in action.
At the same time, Durham acknowledges the many challenges to the conventions posed by new technologies. She says issues such as cyber warfare, artificial intelligence, autonomous weapons, and the changing nature of conflict present new threats. When the conventions were crafted 70 years ago, she says international wars among belligerent states dominated. Now, most wars are internal civil conflicts. She tells VOA, as far back as the 1970s, a survey found a dramatic increase in civilian casualties as a consequence of this change.
In World War I, I think the statistics are 1 out of 9 people killed was a civilian. In World War II, it was around 50-50. And then when we looked at the Vietnam and other wars of decolonization, the statistics inversed, where up to 90% of casualties during conflict were civilians. To date, that continues. So civilians are very often the major casualties.
Durham says an area of major concern for the ICRC is the treatment of detainees. She says clear rules governing the care of prisoners of war are laid out in the conventions. However, these frequently are not enforced in the context of civil wars where non-state actors are involved. She says this is one area where international law must evolve to make the laws of war more relevant to present-day existing reality. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, you might say, a new type of automatic coffee maker. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, vast swaths of southeastern Myanmar lie under floodwaters that have already forced tens of thousands to flee their homes as the death toll from a massive landslide hit 59, according to local firefighters. There are currently more than 80,000 people sheltering at evacuation sites across the country. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for much more on this and other stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Japan is facing a crisis. Its population is aging, and birth rates are dropping. With a declining workforce, businesses are looking to automate jobs in the service industry, and a robotics manufacturer has created a coffee-slinging machine. VOA's Arash Erbasadi brews up this story.
Just a typical morning in Japan, where a robot barista brews the world's favorite liquid motivation.
If customers are entertained, they are happier. That is why we made this robot.
Masahiro Kano runs Qubit Robotics, a company that builds machines that interact with humans in fields like entertainment and food service. He says the technology comes at a critical time for Japan.
We have problems like a decreasing birth rate, an aging population, and employment shortages as a result. In order to help with these problems, we created this robot. We also hope to spread our technology to the rest of the world.
Customers order drinks at a kiosk, and the robo barista does it all, from prep work to cleaning filters. It can make a few more drinks, but coffee is the star. Kano says the robot uses artificial intelligence to improve service.
The AI captures data on the expressions of the customers and what they buy. Using this data, he tries to find ways to improve sales by keeping customers entertained.
The barista flirts a bit, winking and smiling from behind its work desk.
It's very funny, I think. Funny, and it's a new experience. Yes, it's interesting.
Visitors say the coffee's not too bad either.
The aspect of the desk is a little bit strange because the robot looks like a human being. That's what a little bit strange. But for the coffee, I guess it's pretty good.
Qubit Robotics says it looks to sell around 300 robot baristas by 2021. The company currently focuses on beverages, but says it hopes to soon manufacture similar machines to make food like ramen and curry. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia. Thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators filled Hong Kong's international airport Monday, forcing the cancellation of all flights. No violence was reported at one of the world's busiest airports, where protesters still gathered inside the main terminal late into the night. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, 48 insects are currently included on the U.S. Endangered Species list. Unfortunately, the only way any insect has ever come off that list is through extinction. This is especially troubling for the world's butterfly populations, which have declined by 20% over the last decades. Erica Celeste visited one of the rarest wild butterfly populations in the world, the Mitchell Sater butterfly, at the Sauret Nature Center in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and files this report.
This morning we're going to head off down into the wetland, into a very specific kind of wetland called the prairie fen.
This time of year, you can often find Nate Fuller counting butterflies. The director of the Sauret Nature Center needs an accurate count of the Mitchell Sater butterflies to help preserve one of the last known habitats.
They're very particular in the kind of habitat where they can live, which is part of what makes them so rare and amazing indicators for our water quality.
We emerge into a vast wetland of soupy ground covered in shoulder-high grasses and sedges, dotted with poisonous sumac trees. It's slow going, but a cell phone app helps keep track of where the butterflies have been spotted, as well as when and how many. All important data for better understanding Mitchell's Sater populations. Finding the small brown butterflies with golden ringed eye spots on their wings can be difficult. There just aren't many around. They also rest with their wings closed to blend in with their surroundings.
We can step over this way. There's a chance we might stir up a Mitchell Sater.
The Mitchell Sater was placed on the endangered species list in 1991. Initially, it was thought that the loss of wetlands contributed to their decline.
What we knew them from were spring-fed wetlands. So the assumption was that it was a case of invasive plant species, humans destroying wetlands, draining, dredging them.
But as habitats were restored, the Mitchell Sater continued to decline. Fuller says environmentalists realized something more complicated was at work.
The clues seem to suggest that it's not just habitat availability, it's groundwater. And the amount and the quality of groundwater coming into these wetlands seem to be a challenge for the butterfly.
While the decline is likely due to a combination of factors, the fact that the water quality might contribute is unsettling because the wetlands are the headwaters for the Midwest's rivers and streams. A captive breeding program was started 4 years ago at the Toledo Zoo to get to the bottom of the mystery. Ryan Walsh is its director.
So we're starting a captive colony. We'll occasionally collect them to add new genetics to the captive population. And we can really breed a large number of the butterflies. The rest of them, the ones that won't be left back for captive breeding, will be released out into the wild.
The caterpillars spend the winter in a special weather-controlled chamber. That helped determine that the Mitchell satyrs don't do well below 4.4 degrees Celsius, the temperature at which hard freezes in the Fen wetlands will kill the insects. With that knowledge, the program produced 1,300 new eggs this year, something that may go a long way toward restoring the population, and may one day earn the butterflies a ticket off the endangered species list. Meanwhile, back at the Nature Center, our luck isn't so great. In 2 hours, we've only spotted 3 Mitchell satyrs. But Nate Fuller says, if anything, that's a good reason to continue building the breeding program. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Jacqueline Kennedy, the former First Lady of the United States, would have turned 90 years old this year. On the occasion of the anniversary, Maxim Moskalkov visited the house where she first met John F. Kennedy more than a half century ago.
In this Washington, D.C. house, history was made. In the neighborhood known as Georgetown, future President John F. Kennedy met Jacqueline Bouvier at a party for the first time in 1952. Kennedy was an up-and-coming congressman, Bouvier an inspiring journalist. The rest is history, and this house, built in 1895, is a big part of that history. Last year, it was put up for sale. Washington businessperson Scott Stewart, a big fan of JFK, bought it and turned it into something of a museum to the Kennedy legacy.
His ideals were ideals that lined up with mine. I think the optimism that he gave the country at that time, and you know, setting the stage for something that would not be finished, and leaving the nation heartbroken because the story was not played out, left everybody with a sense of wonderment and sense of what could have been.
The Boston native, just like John Kennedy, was the first person shown the home for sale and fell in love and snapped it up quickly.
I walked in into this room that you're in, and I thought the flow was fantastic. It had the perfect amount of space for a guy who was downsizing into an empty nesterhood. And then you tie it all up with the history. It was a no-brainer for me.
The house is a living memory to the Kennedy era, from the portraits to the photographs, magazines, books, and records with presidential speeches. Stewart carefully selected every detail of the interior in the style of the 60s, including this old phone.
The pictures, these giclées that I have here, they were actually in my office. I saw them at the W Hotel on 15th Street. A lot of the things that you see here, they're all gifts. You'd be amazed at how much Kennedy stuff people will give you as a result of having a house like this.
Stewart paid over $1.7 million for the home. He is doing some updating, but says he will, for the most part, keep the home just the way it was in 1952. Maxim Moskalkov, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us on VOA Asia Facebook. You'll find us on our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on another Facebook page. That's VOA Burmese. And we say hello to everyone in Myanmar who is listening to our program today on VOA Facebook Burmese. Thanks so much for joining us. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.